Random House Audio presents The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow. Read for you by Steve West. Chapter 1. The Mystery of Being. We each exist for but a short time, and in that time explore but a small part of the whole universe. But humans are a curious species. We wonder. We seek answers. Living in this vast world that is by turns kind and cruel, and gazing at the immense heavens above, people have always asked a multitude of questions. How can we understand the world in which we find ourselves? How does the universe behave? What is the nature of reality? Where did all this come from? Did the universe need a creator? Most of us do not spend most of our time worrying about these questions, but almost all of us worry about them some of the time. Traditionally, these are questions for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. Philosophy has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly physics. Scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. The purpose of this book is to give the answers that are suggested by recent discoveries and theoretical advances. They lead us to a new picture of the universe and our place in it that is very different from the traditional one, and different even from the picture we might have painted just a decade or two ago. Still, the first sketches of the new concept can be traced back almost a century. According to the traditional conception of the universe, objects move on well-defined paths and have definite histories. We can specify their precise position at each moment in time. Although that account is successful enough for everyday purposes, it was found in the 1920s that this classical picture could not account for the seemingly bizarre behavior observed on the atomic and subatomic scales of existence. Instead, it was necessary to adopt a different framework called quantum physics. Quantum theories have turned out to be remarkably accurate at predicting events on those scales, while also reproducing the predictions of the old classical theories when applied to the macroscopic world of daily life. But quantum and classical physics are based on very different conceptions of physical reality. Quantum theories can be formulated in many different ways, but what is probably the most intuitive description was given by Richard Dick Feynman, a colorful character who worked at the California Institute of Technology and played the bongo drums at a strip joint down the road. According to Feynman, a system has not just one history, but every possible history. As we seek our answers, we will explain Feynman's approach in detail and employ it to explore the idea that the universe itself has no single history, nor even an independent existence. That seems like a radical idea, even to many physicists. Indeed, like many notions in today's science, it appears to violate common sense. But common sense is based upon everyday experience, not upon the universe as it is revealed through the marvels of technology, such as those that allow us to gaze deep into the atom or back to the early universe. Until the advent of modern physics, it was generally thought that all knowledge of the world could be obtained through direct observation, that things are what they seem, as perceived through our senses. But the spectacular success of modern physics, which is based upon concepts such as Feynman's that clash with everyday experience, has shown that that is not the case. The naive view of reality, therefore, is not compatible with modern physics. To deal with such paradoxes, we shall adopt an approach that we call model-dependent realism. It is based on the idea that our brains interpret the input from our sensory organs by making a model of the world. When such a model is successful at explaining events, we tend to attribute to it, and to the elements and concepts that constitute it, the quality of reality or absolute truth. But there may be different ways in which one could model the same physical situation, with each employing different fundamental elements and concepts. If two such physical theories or models accurately predict the same events, one cannot be said to be more real than the other. Rather, we are free to use whichever model is most convenient. In the history of science, we have discovered a sequence of better and better theories or models, From Plato to the classical theory of Newton to modern quantum theories, it is natural to ask, will this sequence eventually reach an endpoint, an ultimate theory of the universe, that will include all forces and predict every observation we can make, or will we continue forever finding better theories, but never one that cannot be improved upon? We do not yet have a definite answer to this question, but we now have a candidate for the ultimate theory of everything, if indeed one exists, called M-theory. M-theory is the only model that has all the properties we think the final theory ought to have, and it is the theory upon which much of our later discussion is based. M-theory is not a theory in the usual sense. It is a whole family of different theories, each of which is a good description of observations only in some range of physical situations. It is a bit like a map. As is well known, one cannot show the whole of the Earth's surface on a single map. The usual Mercator projection used for maps of the world makes areas appear larger and larger in the far north and south, and doesn't cover the north and south poles. To faithfully map the entire Earth, one has to use a collection of maps, each of which covers a limited region. The maps overlap each other, and where they do, they show the same landscape. M-theory is similar. The different theories in the M-theory family may look very different, but they can all be regarded as aspects of the same underlying theory. They are versions of the theory that are applicable only in limited ranges, for example, when certain quantities such as energy are small. Like the overlapping maps in a Mercator projection, where the ranges of different versions overlap, they predict the same phenomena. But just as there is no flat map that is a good representation of the Earth's entire surface, there is no single theory that is a good representation of observations in all situations. We will describe how M-theory may offer answers to the question of creation. According to M-theory, ours is not the only universe. Instead, M-theory predicts that a great many universes were created out of nothing. Their creation does not require the intervention of some supernatural being or God. Rather, these multiple universes arise naturally from physical law. They are a prediction of science. Each universe has many possible histories and many possible states at later times, that is, at times like the present, long after their creation. Most of these states will be quite unlike the universe we observe, and quite unsuitable for the existence of any form of life. Only a very few would allow creatures like us to exist. Thus, our presence selects out from this vast array only those universes that are compatible with our existence. Although we are puny and insignificant on the scale of the cosmos, this makes us, in a sense, the lords of creation. To understand the universe at the deepest level, we need to know not only how the universe behaves, but why. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why do we exist? Why this particular set of laws and not some other? This is the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything. We shall attempt to answer it in this book. Unlike the answer given in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, ours won't be simply 42. Chapter 2. The Rule of Law. Skull the wolf who shall scare the moon, till he flies to the wood of woe. Haughty the wolf, Ridvitna's kin, who shall pursue the sun. Grimnir's Mal, the Elder Edda. In Viking mythology, Skull and Hati chase the sun and the moon. When the wolves catch either one, there is an eclipse. When this happens, the people on Earth rush to rescue the sun or moon by making as much noise as they can in hopes of scaring off the wolves. There are similar myths in other cultures, but after a time people must have noticed that the sun and moon soon emerged from the eclipse, regardless of whether they ran around screaming and banging on things. After a time they must also have noticed that the eclipses didn't just happen at random. They occurred in regular patterns that repeated themselves. These patterns were most obvious for eclipses of the moon and enabled the ancient Babylonians to predict lunar eclipses fairly accurately, even though they didn't realize that they were caused by the Earth blocking the light of the sun. Eclipses of the sun were more difficult to predict because they are visible only in a corridor on the Earth about 30 miles wide. Still, once grasped, the patterns made it clear the eclipses were not dependent on the arbitrary whims of supernatural beings, but rather governed by laws. Despite some early success predicting the motion of celestial bodies, most events in nature appeared to our ancestors to be impossible to predict. Volcanoes, earthquakes, storms, pestilences, and ingrown toenails all seemed to occur without obvious cause or pattern. In ancient times, it was natural to ascribe the violent acts of nature to a pantheon of mischievous or malevolent deities. Calamities were often taken as a sign that we had somehow offended the gods. For example, in about 4800 BC, the Mount Mazama volcano in Oregon erupted, raining rock and burning ash for years, and leading to the many years of rainfall that eventually filled the volcanic crater today called Crater Lake. The Klamath Indians of Oregon have a legend that faithfully matches every geologic detail of the event, but adds a bit of drama by portraying a human as the cause of the catastrophe. The human capacity for guilt is such that people can always find ways to blame themselves. As the legend goes, Lao, the chief of the below world, falls in love with the beautiful human daughter of a Klamath chief. She spurns him, and in revenge Lao tries to destroy the Klamath with fire. Luckily, according to the legend, Skell, the chief of the above world, pities the humans and does battle with his underworld counterpart. Eventually Lao, injured, falls back inside Mount Mazama, leaving a huge hole, the crater that eventually filled with water. Ignorance of nature's ways led people in ancient times to invent gods to lord over every aspect of human life. There were gods of love and war, of the sun, earth, and sky, of the oceans and rivers, of rain and thunderstorms, even of earthquakes and volcanoes. When the gods were pleased, mankind was treated to good weather, peace, and freedom from natural disaster and disease. When they were displeased, there came drought, war, pestilence, and epidemics. Since the connection of cause and effect in nature was invisible to their eyes, these gods appeared inscrutable and people at their mercy. But with Thales of Miletus, circa 624 to 546 BC, about 2,600 years ago, that began to change. The idea arose that nature follows consistent principles that could be deciphered, and so began the long process of replacing the notion of the reign of gods with the concept of a universe that is governed by laws of nature and created according to a blueprint we could someday learn to read. Viewed on the timeline of human history, scientific inquiry is a very new endeavor. Our species, Homo sapiens, originated in sub-Saharan Africa around 200,000 BC. Written language dates back only to about 7,000 BC, the product of societies centered around the cultivation of grain. Some of the oldest written inscriptions concern the daily ration of beer allowed to each citizen. The earliest written records from the great civilization of ancient Greece date back to the 9th century BC, but the height of that civilization, the Classical period, came several hundred years later, beginning a little before 500 BC. According to Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC, it was around that time that Thales first developed the idea that the world can be understood, that the complex happenings around us could be reduced to simpler principles and explained without resorting to mythical or theological explanations. Thales is credited with the first prediction of a solar eclipse in 585 BC, though the great precision of his prediction was probably a lucky guess. He was a shadowy figure who left behind no writings of his own. His home was one of the intellectual centers in a region called Ionia, which was colonized by the Greeks and exerted an influence that eventually reached from Turkey as far west as Italy. Ionian science was an endeavor marked by a strong interest in uncovering fundamental laws to explain natural phenomena, a tremendous milestone in the history of human ideas. Their approach was rational, and in many cases led to conclusions surprisingly similar to what our more sophisticated methods have led us to believe today. It represented a grand beginning. But over the centuries, much of Ionian science would be forgotten, only to be rediscovered or reinvented, sometimes more than once. According to legend, the first mathematical formulation of what we might today call a law of nature dates back to an Ionian named Pythagoras, circa 580 to 490 BC, famous for the theorem named after him that the square of the hypotenuse, longest side, of a right triangle equals the sum of the squares of the other two sides. Pythagoras is said to have discovered the numerical relationship between the length of the strings used in musical instruments and the harmonic combinations of the sounds. In today's language, we would describe that relationship by saying that the frequency, the number of vibrations per second, of a string vibrating under fixed tension is inversely proportional to the length of the string. From the practical point of view, this explains why shorter guitar strings produce a higher pitch than longer ones. Pythagoras probably did not really discover this. He also did not discover the theorem that bears his name, but there is evidence that some relation between string length and pitch was known in his day. If so, one could call that simple mathematical formula the first instance of what we now know as theoretical physics. Apart from the Pythagorean law of strings, the only physical laws known correctly to the ancients were three laws detailed by Archimedes, circa 287 to 212 BC, by far the most eminent physicist of antiquity. In today's terminology, the law of the lever explains that small forces can lift large weights because the lever amplifies a force according to the ratio of the distances from the lever's fulcrum. The law of buoyancy states that any object immersed in fluid will experience an upward force equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. And the law of reflection asserts that the angle between a beam of light and a mirror is equal to the angle between the mirror and the reflected beam. But Archimedes did not call them laws, nor did he explain them with reference to observation and measurement. Instead, he treated them as if they were purely mathematical theorems, in an axiomatic system much like the one Euclid created for geometry. As the Ionian influence spread, there appeared others who saw that the universe possesses an internal order, one that could be understood through observation and reason. Anaximander, circa 610 to 546 BC, a friend and possibly a student of Thales, argued that since human infants are helpless at birth, if the first human had somehow appeared on Earth as an infant, it would not have survived. In what may have been humanity's first inkling of evolution, people, Anaximander reasoned, must therefore have evolved from other animals whose young are hardier. In Sicily, Empedocles, circa 490 to 430 BC, observed the use of an instrument called a clepsydra. Sometimes used as a ladle, it consisted of a sphere with an open neck and small holes in its bottom. When immersed in water, it would fill, and if the open neck was then covered, the clepsydra could be lifted out without the water in it falling through the holes. Empedocles noticed that if you cover the neck before you immerse it, a clepsydra does not fill. He reasoned that something invisible must be preventing the water from entering the sphere through the holes. He had discovered the material substance we call air. Around the same time, Democritus, circa 460 to 370 BC, from an Ionian colony in northern Greece, pondered what happened when you break or cut an object into pieces. He argued that you ought not to be able to continue the process indefinitely. Instead, he postulated that everything, including all living beings, is made of fundamental particles that cannot be cut or broken into parts. He named these ultimate particles atoms, from the Greek adjective meaning uncuttable. Democritus believed that every material phenomenon is a product of the collision of atoms. In his view, dubbed atomism, all atoms move around in space and, unless disturbed, moved forward indefinitely. Today, that idea is called the law of inertia. The revolutionary idea that we are but ordinary inhabitants of the universe, not special beings distinguished by existing at its center, was first championed by Aristarchus, circa 310 to 230 BC, one of the last of the Ionian scientists. Only one of his calculations survives, a complex geometric analysis of careful observations he made of the size of the Earth's shadow on the Moon during a lunar eclipse. He concluded from his data that the Sun must be much larger than the Earth. Perhaps inspired by the idea that tiny objects ought to orbit mammoth ones and not the other way around, he became the first person to argue that the Earth is not the center of our planetary system, but rather that it and the other planets orbit the much larger Sun. It is a small step from the realization that the Earth is just another planet to the idea that our Sun is nothing special either. Aristarchus suspected that this was the case and believed that the stars we see in the night sky are actually nothing more than distant suns. The Ionians were but one of many schools of ancient Greek philosophy, each with different and often contradictory traditions. Unfortunately, the Ionians' view of nature, that it can be explained through general laws and reduced to a simple set of principles, exerted a powerful influence for only a few centuries. One reason is that Ionian theories often seem to have no place for the notion of free will or purpose, or the concept that gods intervene in the workings of the world. These were startling omissions as profoundly unsettling to many Greek thinkers as they are to many people today. The philosopher Epicurus, 341 to 270 BC, for example, opposed atomism on the grounds that it is better to follow the myths about the gods than to become a slave to the destiny of natural philosophers. Aristotle, too, rejected the concept of atoms because he could not accept that human beings were composed of soulless, inanimate objects. The Ionian idea that the universe is not human-centered was a milestone in our understanding of the cosmos, but it was an idea that would be dropped and not picked up again, or commonly accepted, until Galileo, almost 20 centuries later. As insightful as some of their speculations about nature were, most of the ideas of the ancient Greeks would not pass muster as valid science in modern times. For one, because the Greeks had not invented the scientific method, their theories were not developed with the goal of experimental verification. So, if one scholar claimed an atom moved in a straight line until it collided with a second atom, and another scholar claimed it moved in a straight line until it bumped into a cyclops, there was no objective way to settle the argument. Also, there was no clear distinction between human and physical laws. In the 5th century BC, for instance, Anaximander wrote that all things arise from a primary substance and return to it, lest they pay fine and penalty for their iniquity. And according to the Ionian philosopher Heraclitus, circa 535 to 475 BC, the sun behaves as it does because otherwise the goddess of justice will hunt it down. Several hundred years later, the Stoics, a school of Greek philosophers that arose around the 3rd century BC, did make a distinction between human statutes and natural laws, but they included rules of human conduct they considered universal, such as veneration of God and obedience to parents, in the category of natural laws. Conversely, they often described physical processes in legal terms and believed them to be in need of enforcement, even though the objects required to obey the laws were inanimate. If you think it is hard to get humans to follow traffic laws, imagine convincing an asteroid to move along an ellipse. This tradition continued to influence the thinkers who succeeded the Greeks for many centuries thereafter. In the 13th century, the early Christian philosopher Thomas Aquinas, circa 1225 to 1274, adopted this view and used it to argue for the existence of God, writing, "It is clear that inanimate bodies reach their end not by chance, but by intention. There is, therefore, an intelligent personal being by whom everything in nature is ordered to its end." Even as late as the 16th century, the great German astronomer Johann Kepler, 1571 to 1630, believed that planets had sense perception and consciously followed laws of movement that were grasped by their mind. The notion that the laws of nature had to be intentionally obeyed reflects the ancients' focus on why nature behaves as it does, rather than on how it behaves. Aristotle was one of the leading proponents of that approach, rejecting the idea of science based principally on observation. Precise measurement and mathematical calculation were in any case difficult in ancient times. The base 10 number notation we find so convenient for arithmetic dates back only to around AD 700, when the Hindus took the first great strides toward making that subject a powerful tool. The abbreviations for plus and minus didn't come until the 15th century, and neither the equal sign nor clocks that could measure times to the second existed before the 16th century. Aristotle, however, did not see problems in measurement and calculation as impediments to developing a physics that could produce quantitative predictions. Rather, he saw no need to make them. Instead, Aristotle built his physics upon principles that appealed to him intellectually. He suppressed facts he found unappealing and focused his efforts on the reasons things happen, with relatively little energy invested in detailing exactly what was happening. Aristotle did adjust his conclusions when their blatant disagreement with observation could not be ignored, but those adjustments were often ad hoc explanations that did little more than paste over the contradiction. In that manner, no matter how severely his theory deviated from actuality, he could always alter it just enough to seem to remove the conflict. For example, his theory of motion specified that heavy bodies fall with a constant speed that is proportional to their weight. To explain the fact that objects clearly pick up speed as they fall, he invented a new principle, that bodies proceed more jubilantly and hence accelerate when they come closer to their natural place of rest, a principle that today seems a more apt description of certain people than of inanimate objects. Though Aristotle's theories often had little predictive value, his approach to science dominated Western thought for nearly 2,000 years. The Greeks' Christian successors rejected the idea that the universe is governed by indifferent natural law. They also rejected the idea that humans do not hold a privileged place within that universe. And though the medieval period had no single coherent philosophical system, a common theme was that the universe is God's dollhouse, and religion a far worthier study than the phenomena of nature. Indeed, in 1277, Bishop Tempier of Paris, acting on the instructions of Pope John XXI, published a list of 219 errors or heresies that were to be condemned. Among the heresies was the idea that nature follows laws, because this conflicts with God's omnipotence. Interestingly, Pope John was killed by the effects of the law of gravity a few months later, when the roof of his palace fell in on him. The modern concept of laws of nature emerged in the 17th century. Kepler seems to have been the first scientist to understand the term in the sense of modern science, though as we've said, he retained an animistic view of physical objects. Galileo, 1564 to 1642, did not use the term law in his most scientific works, though it appears in some translations of those works. Whether or not he used the word, however, Galileo did uncover a great many laws, and advocated the important principles that observation is the basis of science, and that the purpose of science is to research the quantitative relationships that exist between physical phenomena. But the person who first explicitly and rigorously formulated the concept of laws of nature as we understand them was René Descartes, 1596 to 1650. Descartes believed that all physical phenomena must be explained in terms of the collisions of moving masses, which were governed by three laws, precursors of Newton's famous laws of motion. He asserted that those laws of nature were valid in all places and at all times, and stated explicitly that obedience to these laws does not imply that these moving bodies have minds. Descartes also understood the importance of what we today call initial conditions. Those describe the state of a system at the beginning of whatever interval of time over which one seeks to make predictions. With a given set of initial conditions, the laws of nature determine how a system will evolve over time, but without a specific set of initial conditions, the evolution cannot be specified. If, for example, at time zero a pigeon directly overhead lets something go, the path of that falling object is determined by Newton's laws. But the outcome will be very different depending on whether, at time zero, the pigeon is sitting still on a telephone wire or flying by at 20 miles per hour. In order to apply the laws of physics, one must know how a system started off, or at least its state at some definite time. One can also use the laws to follow a system backward in time. With this renewed belief in the existence of laws of nature came new attempts to reconcile those laws with the concept of God. According to Descartes, God could at will alter the truth or falsity of ethical propositions or mathematical theorems, but not nature. He believed that God ordained the laws of nature, but had no choice in the laws. Rather, he picked them because the laws we experience are the only possible laws. This would seem to impinge on God's authority, but Descartes got around that by arguing that the laws are unalterable because they are a reflection of God's own intrinsic nature. If that were true, one might think that God still had the choice of creating a variety of different worlds, each corresponding to a different set of initial conditions, but Descartes also denied this. No matter what the arrangement of matter at the beginning of the universe, he argued, over time a world identical to ours would evolve. Moreover, Descartes felt, once God set the world going, he left it entirely alone. A similar position was adopted by Isaac Newton, 1643-1727. Newton was the person who won widespread acceptance of the modern concept of a scientific law, with his three laws of motion and his law of gravity, which accounted for the orbits of the Earth, Moon, and planets, and explained phenomena such as the tides. The handful of equations he created, and the elaborate mathematical framework we have since derived from them, are still taught today, and employed whenever an architect designs a building, an engineer designs a car, or a physicist calculates how to aim a rocket meant to land on Mars. As the poet Alexander Pope said, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, 'Let Newton be,' and all was light." Today, most scientists would say a law of nature is a rule that is based upon an observed regularity and provides predictions that go beyond the immediate situations upon which it is based. For example, we might notice that the sun has risen in the east every morning of our lives and postulate the law, "The sun always rises in the east." This is a generalization that goes beyond our limited observations of the rising sun and makes testable predictions about the future. On the other hand, a statement such as, "The computers in this office are black," is not a law of nature because it relates only to the computers within the office and makes no predictions such as, "If my office purchases a new computer, it will be black." Our modern understanding of the term law of nature is an issue philosophers argue at length, and it is a more subtle question than one may at first think. For example, the philosopher John W. Carroll compared the statement, "All gold spheres are less than a mile in diameter," to a statement like, "All uranium-235 spheres are less than a mile in diameter." Our observations of the world tell us that there are no gold spheres larger than a mile wide, and we can be pretty confident there never will be. Still, we have no reason to believe that there couldn't be one, and so the statement is not considered a law. On the other hand, the statement, "All uranium-235 spheres are less than a mile in diameter," could be thought of as a law of nature because, according to what we know about nuclear physics, once a sphere of uranium-235 grew to a diameter greater than about 6 inches, it would demolish itself in a nuclear explosion. Hence, we can be sure that such spheres do not exist, nor would it be a good idea to try to make one. This distinction matters because it illustrates that not all generalizations we observe can be thought of as laws of nature, and that most laws of nature exist as part of a larger, interconnected system of laws. In modern science, laws of nature are usually phrased in mathematics. They can be either exact or approximate, but they must have been observed to hold without exception, if not universally, then at least under a stipulated set of conditions. For example, we now know that Newton's laws must be modified if objects are moving at velocities near the speed of light. Yet we still consider Newton's laws to be laws because they hold, at least to a very good approximation, for the conditions of the everyday world, in which the speeds we encounter are far below the speed of light. If nature is governed by laws, three questions arise. 1. What is the origin of the laws? 2. Are there any exceptions to the laws, i.e., miracles? 3. Is there only one set of possible laws? These important questions have been addressed in varying ways by scientists, philosophers, and theologians. The answer traditionally given to the first question, the answer of Kepler, Galileo, Descartes, and Newton, was that the laws were the work of God. However, this is no more than a definition of God as the embodiment of the laws of nature. Unless one endows God with some other attributes, such as being the God of the Old Testament, employing God as a response to the first question merely substitutes one mystery for another. So if we involve God in the answer to the first question, the real crunch comes with the second question. Are there miracles, exceptions to the laws? Opinions about the answer to the second question have been sharply divided. Plato and Aristotle, the most influential ancient Greek writers, held that there can be no exceptions to the laws. But if one takes the biblical view, then God not only created the laws, but can be appealed to by prayer to make exceptions, to heal the terminally ill, to bring premature ends to droughts, or to reinstate croquet as an Olympic sport. In opposition to Descartes' view, almost all Christian thinkers maintain that God must be able to suspend the laws to accomplish miracles. Even Newton believed in miracles of a sort. He thought that the orbit of the planets would be unstable because the gravitational attraction of one planet for another would cause disturbances to the orbits that would grow with time and would result in the planets either falling into the sun or being flung out of the solar system. God must keep on resetting the orbits, he believed, or wind the celestial watch, lest it run down. However, Pierre Simon, Marquis de Laplace, 1749-1827, commonly known as Laplace, argued that the perturbations would be periodic, that is, marked by repeated cycles, rather than being cumulative. The solar system would thus reset itself, and there would be no need for divine intervention to explain why it had survived to the present day. It is Laplace who is usually credited with first clearly postulating scientific determinism. Given the state of the universe at one time, a complete set of laws fully determines both the future and the past. This would exclude the possibility of miracles or an active role for God. The scientific determinism that Laplace formulated is the modern scientist's answer to question two. It is, in fact, the basis of all modern science, and a principle that is important throughout this book. A scientific law is not a scientific law if it holds only when some supernatural being decides not to intervene. Recognizing this, Napoleon is said to have asked Laplace how God fit into this picture. Laplace replied, "Sire, I have not needed that hypothesis." Since people live in the universe and interact with the other objects in it, scientific determinism must hold for people as well. Many, however, while accepting that scientific determinism governs physical processes, would make an exception for human behavior because they believe we have free will. Descartes, for instance, in order to preserve the idea of free will, asserted that the human mind was something different from the physical world and did not follow its laws. In his view, a person consists of two ingredients, a body and a soul. Bodies are nothing but ordinary machines, but the soul is not subject to scientific law. Descartes was very interested in anatomy and physiology and regarded a tiny organ in the center of the brain, called the pineal gland, as the principal seat of the soul. That gland, he believed, was the place where all our thoughts are formed, the wellspring of our free will. Do people have free will? If we have free will, where in the evolutionary tree did it develop? Do blue-green algae or bacteria have free will? Or is their behavior automatic and within the realm of scientific law? Is it only multicelled organisms that have free will, or only mammals? We might think that a chimpanzee is exercising free will when it chooses to chomp on a banana, or a cat when it rips up your sofa. But what about the roundworm called Caenorhabditis elegans, a simple creature made of only 959 cells? It probably never thinks, "That was damn tasty bacteria I got to dine on back there." Yet it too has a definite preference in food and will either settle for an unattractive meal or go foraging for something better, depending on recent experience. Is that the exercise of free will? Though we feel that we can choose what we do, our understanding of the molecular basis of biology shows that biological processes are governed by the laws of physics and chemistry, and therefore are as determined as the orbits of the planets. Recent experiments in neuroscience support the view that it is our physical brain, following the known laws of science, that determines our actions, and not some agency that exists outside those laws. For example, a study of patients undergoing awake brain surgery found that by electrically stimulating the appropriate regions of the brain, one could create in the patient the desire to move the hand, arm, or foot, or to move the lips and talk. It is hard to imagine how free will can operate if our behavior is determined by physical law, so it seems that we are no more than biological machines and that free will is just an illusion. While conceding that human behavior is indeed determined by the laws of nature, it also seems reasonable to conclude that the outcome is determined in such a complicated way and with so many variables as to make it impossible in practice to predict. For that, one would need a knowledge of the initial state of each of the 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 molecules in the human body and to solve something like that number of equations. That would take a few billion years, which would be a bit late to duck when the person opposite aimed a blow. Because it is so impractical to use the underlying physical laws to predict human behavior, we adopt what is called an effective theory. In physics, an effective theory is a framework created to model certain observed phenomena without describing in detail all of the underlying processes. For example, we cannot solve exactly the equations governing the gravitational interactions of every atom in a person's body with every atom in the Earth. But for all practical purposes, the gravitational force between a person and the Earth can be described in terms of just a few numbers, such as the person's total mass. Similarly, we cannot solve the equations governing the behavior of complex atoms and molecules, but we have developed an effective theory called chemistry that provides an adequate explanation of how atoms and molecules behave in chemical reactions without accounting for every detail of the interactions. In the case of people, since we cannot solve the equations that determine our behavior, we use the effective theory that people have free will. The study of our will and of the behavior that arises from it is the science of psychology. Economics is also an effective theory based on the notion of free will plus the assumption that people evaluate their possible alternative courses of action and choose the best. That effective theory is only moderately successful in predicting behavior because, as we all know, decisions are often not rational or are based on a defective analysis of the consequences of the choice. That is why the world is in such a mess. The third question addresses the issue of whether the laws that determine both the universe and human behavior are unique. If your answer to the first question is that God created the laws, then this question asks, did God have any latitude in choosing them? Both Aristotle and Plato believed, like Descartes and later Einstein, that the principles of nature exist out of necessity, That is, because they are the only rules that make logical sense. Due to his belief in the origin of the laws of nature in logic, Aristotle and his followers felt that one could derive those laws without paying a lot of attention to how nature actually behaved. That and the focus on why objects follow rules rather than on the specifics of what the rules are led him to mainly qualitative laws that were often wrong and in any case did not prove very useful, even if they did dominate scientific thought for many centuries. It is only much later that people such as Galileo dared to challenge the authority of Aristotle and observe what nature actually did rather than what pure reason said it ought to do. This book is rooted in the concept of scientific determinism, which implies that the answer to question 2 is that there are no miracles or exceptions to the laws of nature. We will, however, return to address in depth questions 1 and 3, the issues of how the laws arose and whether they are the only possible laws. But first, in the next chapter, we will address the issue of what it is that the laws of nature describe. Most scientists would say they are the mathematical reflection of an external reality that exists independent of the observer who sees it. But as we ponder the manner in which we observe and form concepts about our surroundings, we bump into the question, do we really have reason to believe that an objective reality exists? Chapter 3. What is reality? A few years ago, the city council of Monza, Italy, barred pet owners from keeping goldfish in curved goldfish bowls. The measure's sponsor explained the measure in part by saying that it is cruel to keep a fish in a bowl with curved sides because, gazing out, the fish would have a distorted view of reality. But how do we know we have the true, undistorted picture of reality? Might not we ourselves also be inside some big goldfish bowl and have our vision distorted by an enormous lens? The goldfish's picture of reality is different from ours, but can we be sure it is less real? The goldfish view is not the same as our own, but goldfish could still formulate scientific laws governing the motion of the objects they observe outside their bowl. For example, due to the distortion, a freely moving object that we would observe to move in a straight line would be observed by the goldfish to move along a curved path. Nevertheless, the goldfish could formulate scientific laws from their distorted frame of reference that would always hold true and that would enable them to make predictions about the future motion of objects outside the bowl. Their laws would be more complicated than the laws in our frame, but simplicity is a matter of taste. If a goldfish formulated such a theory, we would have to admit the goldfish's view as a valid picture of reality. A famous example of different pictures of reality is the model introduced around AD 150 by Ptolemy, circa 85 to 165, to describe the motion of the celestial bodies. Ptolemy published his work in a 13-book treatise usually known under its Arabic title, Almagest. The Almagest begins by explaining reasons for thinking that the Earth is spherical, motionless, positioned at the center of the universe, and negligibly small in comparison to the distance of the heavens. Despite Aristarchus's heliocentric model, these beliefs had been held by most educated Greeks, at least since the time of Aristotle, who believed for mystical reasons that the Earth should be at the center of the universe. In Ptolemy's model, the Earth stood still at the center, and the planets and the stars moved around it in complicated orbits involving epicycles, like wheels on wheels. This model seemed natural because we don't feel the Earth under our feet moving, except in earthquakes or moments of passion. Later European learning was based on the Greek sources that had been passed down, so that the ideas of Aristotle and Ptolemy became the basis for much of Western thought. Ptolemy's model of the cosmos was adopted by the Catholic Church and held as official doctrine for 1400 years. It was not until 1543 that an alternative model was put forward by Copernicus in his book De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium, on the revolutions of the celestial spheres. published only in the year of his death, though he had worked on his theory for several decades. Copernicus, like Aristarchus some 17 centuries earlier, described a world in which the sun was at rest and the planets revolved around it in circular orbits. Though the idea wasn't new, its revival was met with passionate resistance. The Copernican model was held to contradict the Bible, which was interpreted as saying that the planets moved around the Earth, even though the Bible never clearly stated that. In fact, at the time the Bible was written, people believed the Earth was flat. The Copernican model led to a furious debate as to whether the Earth was at rest, culminating in Galileo's trial for heresy in 1633, for advocating the Copernican model, and for thinking that one may hold and defend as probable an opinion after it has been declared and defined contrary to the Holy Scripture. He was found guilty, confined to house arrest for the rest of his life, and forced to recant. He is said to have muttered under his breath, "Epur si muove," but still it moves. In 1992, the Roman Catholic Church finally acknowledged that it had been wrong to condemn Galileo. So which is real, the Ptolemaic or Copernican system? Although it is not uncommon for people to say that Copernicus proved Ptolemy wrong, that is not true. As in the case of our normal view versus that of the goldfish, one can use either picture as a model of the universe, for our observations of the heavens can be explained by assuming either the Earth or the Sun to be at rest. Despite its role in philosophical debates over the nature of our universe, the real advantage of the Copernican system is simply that the equations of motion are much simpler in the frame of reference in which the Sun is at rest. A different kind of alternative reality occurs in the science fiction film The Matrix, in which the human race is unknowingly living in a simulated virtual reality created by intelligent computers to keep them pacified and content while the computers suck their bioelectrical energy, whatever that is. Maybe this is not so far-fetched, because many people prefer to spend their time in the simulated reality of websites such as Second Life. How do we know we are not just characters in a computer-generated soap opera? If we lived in a synthetic imaginary world, events would not necessarily have any logic or consistency or obey any laws. The aliens in control might find it more interesting or amusing to see our reactions, for example, if the full moon split in half, or everyone in the world on a diet developed an uncontrollable craving for banana cream pie. But if the aliens did enforce consistent laws, there is no way we could tell there was another reality behind the simulated one. It would be easy to call the world the aliens live in the real one and the synthetic world a false one. But if, like us, the beings in the simulated world could not gaze into their universe from the outside, there would be no reason for them to doubt their own pictures of reality. This is a modern version of the idea that we are all figments of someone else's dream. These examples bring us to a conclusion that will be important in this book. There is no picture or theory-independent concept of reality. Instead, we will adopt a view that we will call model-dependent realism, the idea that a physical theory or world picture is a model, generally of a mathematical nature, and a set of rules that connect the elements of the model to observations. This provides a framework with which to interpret modern science. Philosophers from Plato onward have argued over the years about the nature of reality. Classical science is based on the belief that there exists a real external world whose properties are definite and independent of the observer who perceives them. According to classical science, certain objects exist and have physical properties, such as speed and mass, that have well-defined values. In this view, our theories are attempts to describe those objects and their properties, and our measurements and perceptions correspond to them. Both observer and observed are parts of a world that has an objective existence, and any distinction between them has no meaningful significance. In other words, if you see a herd of zebras fighting for a spot in the parking garage, it is because there really is a herd of zebras fighting for a spot in the parking garage. all other observers who look will measure the same properties, and the herd will have those properties whether anyone observes them or not. In philosophy, that belief is called realism. Though realism may be a tempting viewpoint, as we'll see later, what we know about modern physics makes it a difficult one to defend. For example, according to the principles of quantum physics, which is an accurate description of nature, a particle has neither a definite position nor a definite velocity unless and until those quantities are measured by an observer. It is therefore not correct to say that a measurement gives a certain result, because the quantity being measured had that value at the time of the measurement. In fact, in some cases, individual objects don't even have an independent existence, but rather exist only as part of an ensemble of many. And if a theory called the holographic principle proves correct, we and our four-dimensional world may be shadows on the boundary of a larger, five-dimensional space-time. In that case, our status in the universe is analogous to that of the goldfish. Strict realists often argue that the proof that scientific theories represent reality lies in their success, but different theories can successfully describe the same phenomenon through disparate conceptual frameworks. In fact, many scientific theories that had proven successful were later replaced by other, equally successful theories based on wholly new concepts of reality. Traditionally, those who didn't accept realism have been called anti-realists. Anti-realists suppose a distinction between empirical knowledge and theoretical knowledge. They typically argue that observation and experiment are meaningful, but that theories are no more than useful instruments that do not embody any deeper truths underlying the observed phenomena. Some anti-realists have even wanted to restrict science to things that can be observed. For that reason, many in the 19th century rejected the idea of atoms on the grounds that we would never see one. George Berkeley, 1685 to 1753, even went as far as to say that nothing exists except the mind and its ideas. When a friend remarked to English author and lexicographer Dr. Samuel Johnson, 1709 to 1784, that Berkeley's claim could not possibly be refuted, Johnson is said to have responded by walking over to a large stone, kicking it, and proclaiming, "I refute it thus." Of course, the pain Dr. Johnson experienced in his foot was also an idea in his mind, so he wasn't really refuting Berkeley's ideas. But his act did illustrate the view of philosopher David Hume, 1711 to 1776, who wrote that although we have no rational grounds for believing in an objective reality, we also have no choice but to act as if it is true. Model-dependent realism short-circuits all this argument and discussion between the realist and anti-realist schools of thought. According to model-dependent realism, it is pointless to ask whether a model is real, only whether it agrees with observation. If there are two models that both agree with observation, like the goldfish's picture and ours, then one cannot say that one is more real than another. One can use whichever model is more convenient in the situation under consideration. For example, if one were inside the bowl, the goldfish's picture would be useful, but for those outside, it would be very awkward to describe events from a distant galaxy in the frame of a bowl on Earth, especially because the bowl would be moving as the Earth orbits the Sun and spins on its axis. We make models in science, but we also make them in everyday life. Model-dependent realism applies not only to scientific models, but also to the conscious and subconscious mental models we all create in order to interpret and understand the everyday world. There is no way to remove the observer, us, from our perception of the world, which is created through our sensory processing and through the way we think and reason. Our perception, and hence the observations upon which our theories are based, is not direct, but rather it is shaped by a kind of lens, the interpretive structure of our human brains. Model-dependent realism corresponds to the way we perceive objects. In vision, one's brain receives a series of signals down the optic nerve. Those signals do not constitute the sort of image you would accept on your television. There is a blind spot where the optic nerve attaches to the retina, and the only part of your field of vision with good resolution is a narrow area of about 1 degree of visual angle around the retina's center, an area the width of your thumb when held at arm's length. And so the raw data sent to the brain are like a badly pixelated picture with a hole in it. Fortunately, the human brain processes that data, combining the input from both eyes, filling in gaps on the assumption that the visual properties of neighboring locations are similar and interpolating. Moreover, it reads a two-dimensional array of data from the retina and creates from it the impression of three-dimensional space. The brain, in other words, builds a mental picture or model. The brain is so good at model building that if people are fitted with glasses that turn the images in their eyes upside down, their brains, after a time, change the model so that they again see things the right way up. If the glasses are then removed, they see the world upside down for a while, then again adapt. This shows that what one means when one says, "I see a chair," is merely that one has used the light scattered by the chair to build a mental image or model of the chair. If the model is upside down, with luck, one's brain will correct it before one tries to sit on the chair. Another problem that model-dependent realism solves, or at least avoids, is the meaning of existence. How do I know that a table still exists if I go out of the room and can't see it? What does it mean to say that things we can't see, such as electrons or quarks, the particles that are said to make up the proton and neutron, exist? One could have a model in which the table disappears when I leave the room and reappears in the same position when I come back, but that would be awkward. And what if something happened when I was out, like the ceiling falling in? How, under the table disappears when I leave the room model, could I account for the fact that the next time I enter, the table reappears broken under the debris of the ceiling? The model in which the table stays put is much simpler and agrees with observation. That is all one can ask. In the case of subatomic particles that we can't see, electrons are a useful model that explains observations like tracks in a cloud chamber and the spots of light on a television tube, as well as many other phenomena. It is said that the electron was discovered in 1897 by British physicist J.J. Thomson at the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge University. He was experimenting with currents of electricity inside empty glass tubes, a phenomenon known as cathode rays. His experiments led him to the bold conclusion that the mysterious rays were composed of minuscule corpuscles that were material constituents of atoms, which were then thought to be the indivisible fundamental unit of matter. Thomson did not see an electron, nor was his speculation directly or unambiguously demonstrated by his experiments, but the model has proved crucial in applications from fundamental science to engineering, and today all physicists believe in electrons, even though you cannot see them. Quarks, which we also cannot see, are a model to explain the properties of the protons and neutrons in the nucleus of an atom. Though protons and neutrons are said to be made of quarks, we will never observe a quark because the binding force between quarks increases with separation, and hence isolated, free quarks cannot exist in nature. Instead, they always occur in groups of three, protons and neutrons, or in pairings of a quark and an antiquark, pi mesons, and behave as if they were joined by rubber bands. The question of whether it makes sense to say quarks really exist if you can never isolate one was a controversial issue in the years after the quark model was first proposed. The idea that certain particles were made of different combinations of a few sub-subnuclear particles provided an organizing principle that yielded a simple and attractive explanation for their properties. But although physicists were accustomed to accepting particles that were only inferred to exist from statistical blips in data pertaining to the scattering of other particles, the idea of assigning reality to a particle that might be, in principle, unobservable was too much for many physicists. Over the years, however, as the quark model led to more and more correct predictions, that opposition faded. It is certainly possible that some alien beings with 17 arms, infrared eyes, and a habit of blowing clotted cream out their ears would make the same experimental observations that we do, but describe them without quarks. Nevertheless, according to model-dependent realism, quarks exist in a model that agrees with our observations of how subnuclear particles behave. Model-dependent realism can provide a framework to discuss questions such as, if the world was created a finite time ago, what happened before that? An early Christian philosopher, St. Augustine, 354 to 430, said that the answer was not that God was preparing hell for people who ask such questions, but that time was a property of the world that God created, and that time did not exist before the creation, which he believed had occurred not that long ago. That is one possible model, which is favored by those who maintain that the account given in Genesis is literally true, even though the world contains fossil and other evidence that makes it look much older. Were they put there to fool us? One can also have a different model in which time continues back 13.7 billion years to the Big Bang. The model that explains the most about our present observations, including the historical and geological evidence, is the best representation we have of the past. The second model can explain the fossil and radioactive records and the fact that we receive light from galaxies millions of light years from us, and so this model, the Big Bang theory, is more useful than the first. Still, neither model can be said to be more real than the other. Some people support a model in which time goes back even further than the Big Bang. It is not yet clear whether a model in which time continued back beyond the Big Bang would be better at explaining present observations, because it seems the laws of the evolution of the universe may break down at the Big Bang. If they do, it would make no sense to create a model that encompasses time before the Big Bang, because what existed then would have no observable consequences for the present. And so we might as well stick with the idea that the Big Bang was the creation of the world.